Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We have a lot of head for you in this hour. Everything from time change and politics to the Appalachian field recordings of Alan Lomax and a lot more. First, our body clock. While we may welcome the prospect of staying on just one time setting year-round, no more springing forward or falling back by an hour, many think that with the Sunshine Protection Act, which was passed unanimously by the Senate in March and now before the House, Congress is abolishing the wrong setting and should make standard time permanent instead of daylight savings. Which is best for most? Bruce O'Hara joins us from the University of Kentucky, where he is a biologist who studies sleep and circadian rhythms. Dr. O'Hara, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
And so let's start with a definition. What is circadian rhythm, and why is it important that it not be disrupted?
Yeah, so circadian rhythms are 24-hour rhythms that we have that are endogenously generated, right? You know, you might imagine animals or us responding to the light and dark, and we'd have 24-hour events of sleep and wake and so on. But we also have this internal clock that keeps time, and that affects when we are more likely to be sleepy, awake. It affects our body temperature. It affects our hormone levels. It affects almost every aspect of our physiology. And we're finding more and more about all of these interconnections affecting almost every disease process, too. So it's good to have robust circadian rhythms. And light is one of the main things that entrains our clock, because our endogenous clock is not perfectly 24 hours. It might be 24.2. And that might sound, does that matter? Well, it does, because you have to adjust a little bit each day. And you really need morning light is the most effective to adjust that, because that we call phase advance the clock to bring us back to perfectly 24 hours.
Well, we've tried this before. We tried going with year-round daylight. First was 1942 to 45. World War II was going on, and it was an effort to conserve fuel back then. It was done again as a trial in 1974, but you went right back to standard time before the year's end after a lot of pushback from the public. Should we be paying attention to that pushback now? Has anything changed?
Yeah, I think that was a good example, because initially it was very popular. People thought, oh, yeah, have the longer days year round. And then when people started seeing, oh, but you're not getting the light in the morning and you're getting up more in the dark, people recognized, without knowing the science behind it, they just recognized it wasn't as appealing. Now, of course, there are going to be some people that really do want that longer day. But we, again, know that biologically and for our health, again, the morning light seems to be more important. And that's especially true, I would argue, here in central Kentucky, because you know, we're at the western edge of the time zone. So our noon sun right now is not until 1:45, right? Because we have an hour, we're on daylight savings now, so it's an hour later. And then we're 45 minutes sunrise later than, say, New York City, which is right about where it should be sun time. So we're already a very late sunrise, you know, already here in central Kentucky, and now we've added an hour to it.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, as animals, we've long been linked to the sun, of course, but with the invention of electricity and then lately the personal computer and all kinds of devices, haven't people's biological clocks been messed with for a long time now, regardless of time change?
Yes, to some extent. I mean, you could go back to even fire and so on, but we've always had moonlight and some disruptions. Natural sunlight is still the overwhelming Zeitgeber. So although, yeah, you could imagine, well, does it really matter what the clock time says? I mean, in theory, if we moved schools to an hour later and work an hour later and everything an hour later with daylight savings, then it wouldn't really matter, right? But we don't. We're keeping, you know, the 9-to-5 work schedule, or high schools that start at 8 o'clock, which is already too early. And now we're changing the clock so that people have to get up before the sun rises even earlier. And you can't fool our bodies from that. So yeah, we've always adjusted with human societies a little bit. And like you say, been disrupted for some time. And then electric lights, of course, greatly augmented that potential problem. But natural light is still the strongest time giver. We call it Zeitgeber from the German time giver.
Well, I'm glad you brought up school, because I was going to ask you about teenagers. I've read that modern-day adolescents are already the most sleep-deprived population in human history. Is daylight saving time particularly dangerous for teens?
Yeah, I would argue of all the people that are going to suffer the most, it's teenagers, if we went to permanent daylight savings, because there's already been overwhelming data that later high school start times really benefit everybody. In fact, there's almost nothing we can do for our high schools better than start them later. And a lot of high schools have. Hundreds and hundreds of high schools across the country have recognized this and done it. Many others recognize it, but because of busing and sports and other factors, can't seem to manage to move it later. But now, if we keep daylight savings, that's another 4 months in the winter where, again, in Kentucky, that will be like an 8:45 a.m. sunrise. So we know that the teenagers have this natural shift to more nighttime behavior, right? You know, usually 7, 8, 9-year-old kids are fine going to bed at 8 o'clock at night. Teenagers, not so much, right? Stay up till midnight. Mm-hmm. And even if they try to go to bed at 10 or 11, and they, tend to be sleep deprived. They have to get up at 6 a.m., say, or 6:30 for 8 a.m. classes. And they're already suffering daylight savings again. That would add another hour earlier they would have to get up.
What do you say to the argument that if we just adapt to daylight savings permanently, we'll be fine with it because we'll eventually just get used to it? But is that really the case?
No, see, that's where the sunrise is still sunrise. And you can, theoretically, we could have really intense indoor lights that come on and everybody could shift their clock, but nobody really does that. Like shift workers, we know, suffer tremendously. Those who work, especially the graveyard shift, right? Midnight to 8 a.m. or so. And in theory, they could shift all their light and dark, go to bed at the right time, and couldn't they just shift their internal clock to that time schedule? The answer is no, almost never. And now an hour is not so bad, right? We're talking not nearly as big an effect as shift workers face, but it's still pretty significant, like I said, especially for the teenagers. They're already maybe getting, 6 hours, 7 hours of sleep when 8 or 9 would be better. Now, under daylight savings in the winter, that's likely to lose maybe another half hour of sleep. And that adds up over a big population. So I think especially teenagers, it's unlikely teenagers will ever adapt to that. And there's some studies that show that all throughout the summer of daylight savings, people don't fully entrain to the new time. It's only an hour, so for many people, it doesn't impact them very negatively. But for some people, they're kind of living with a constant jet lag, you can think of it as.
Well, if in the end the House does go along with the Senate and passes this Sunshine Protection Act, they must have had a focus group to come up with that one.
Yeah.
If they pass this and the president signs it into law, what can we expect to experience under permanent daylight savings time? Is this going to mess with us?
Yeah, well, there is the one advantage, right? We wouldn't have to change the clocks twice a year. We know the clock change has some problems.
Right.
The bigger problem is not the fall, right, where we move the hour back because we gain an hour and usually gain a little bit of sleep. It's the spring one where we spring forward and lose sleep and have to get up that much earlier. So we do save that shift. But again, especially in central Kentucky, you're talking 8:45 a.m. sunrises in the winter. 7:45 is already pretty late, right? We already have a pretty late sunrise. The kids are already getting up, all of us getting up in the dark, right? Now it'll be even darker for longer. Even already arriving at school, it'll still be dark.
Well, this legislation is kind of sitting at the moment. The House is expected to act on it at some point during the year, so we'll just have to keep our eye on it, and we might be coming back to you.
Okay, thanks so much. Thanks so much. And I might want to just point out that the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, the Society for Research on Biological Rhythms, have put out papers really looking at all of this evidence that really does argue for standard time. I understand the other arguments for some people prefer the longer days, but the medical communities have pretty much 100% agreed that standard time would be better.
All right. University of Kentucky biology professor and researcher Bruce O'Hara. Thank you, Dr. O'Hara.
Yeah, thank you.
David Catnese joins us from Washington, where he is a national political correspondent for McClatchy. You may have read his recent article in the Lexington Herald Leader under the headline, "All Politics is National, How Kentucky's Congressional Districts Have Slid Off the Map." Thanks for joining us, David.
Thanks for having me.
So, former House Speaker Tip O'Neill was often quoted as saying all politics is local. What did he mean by that?
Well, he meant that if you went back to your district, even if you disagreed with your own party, and you delivered for your district, you did constituency services, you could get reelected, even if your constituents didn't align with you on some big issues. It was sort of that old sort of motto that, hey, I don't necessarily agree with you on everything, but I respect the person and I trust them. And I think in today's climate, that slogan is no longer operable.
And your article argues that, in fact, all of politics is national. And you write that Kentucky's congressional districts, much like a majority across the country, are becoming more partisan and less competitive. What are your observations about congressional districting here in Kentucky?
So I got this idea because the primary is coming up in May in Kentucky, and I just started looking over the congressional districts in the state, and it struck me that none of these seats are going to be competitive in the general election. And 10 years ago, when I began covering national politics in Washington, I remember that the Lexington seat currently held by Andy Barr was always competitive. So I actually reached out to Ben Chandler, the last Democrat to hold Lexington's congressional seat. And I said, why is this seat not even on the map anymore? This was a seat that Democrats would usually pour millions and millions of dollars into only a decade ago. No longer. It's off the map. And Chandler, very gracious with his time, I spoke to him for a long, lengthy interview. He told me that all politics is national now. And pretty simply, it's very tough to be a moderate, to talk about doing government efficiently, to doing it in a fiscal conservative way, to be out of line with your party. People aren't interested in that. They're interested in cultural touchstones, and that makes it much more difficult to get elected in a place like Kentucky where partisanship is hardening. But if this is not unique to Kentucky, and I want to sort of underline that for your listeners, This is going on all across the country in red states and blue. It is just very hard to be out of sync with your national party and win. In states that where most voters don't identify with your political party.
Well, it's been clear for quite a while now that red America and blue America are becoming like two different countries claiming the same territory, two different versions of the Constitution, two different versions of economics, even history. Do these legislative actions kind of harden that fracture?
I think overall the focus of Washington and frankly the focus of some of the media hardens the fractures. You do have some good intentioned lawmakers that come to Washington and want to work on substantive issues. But what gets caught up in the media rapture? Cultural touchstones. I mean, now we're talking about, you know, whether masks should be on or off in certain cities every day, critical race theory, trans rights, frankly, things that affect a much smaller number of people than the broader economic, fiscal sort of kitchen table issues. But, you know, Chandler said to me, it's hard to even talk about that anymore. And I think another reason is our polarized media atmosphere. Chandler told me that when he was polling in the district, he found that, you know, more than 60% of constituents were getting mostly their news from Fox. So if you're on the right, you go to Fox, you go to Breitbart, maybe you go to Newsmax. If you're on the left, you hit up CNN, MSNBC, you know, maybe the Huffington Post. That sort of goes back to the all politics is national. People are getting their information siloed from people that they want to hear from because they agree with them rather than, you know, straight news organizations that are going to challenge some of your preconceived notions at times. And that makes it much, much more difficult to break through, even if you have an issue that may resonate with your constituents.
To what extent do you think this nationalization of politics can be connected to the decline of local news operations, especially those that are large enough to have a Capitol Bureau? Of course, a lot of those have been trimmed or even eliminated in recent years. But is there a connection, do you think?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, working for McClatchy, we own 30 newspapers across the country, mostly regional and local newspapers. That's what I'm trying to do in Washington, is provide those local readers a Washington perspective on their representatives. But it's a lot tougher, and COVID made it tougher. You know, how many people actually get the printed out newspaper anymore? That is obviously changing. Newspapers struggled to try to figure out the new digital economy where everyone's on a smartphone or a tablet all day. It's more competitive, frankly, to cover politics. There are so many more outlets and websites than when I started in this business. You're competing with tweets. You're competing with YouTube videos. Candidates can now go directly to the internet. They don't have to sit with their local newspaper editorial board and get, you know, drilled by 30 questions over an hour period of time and answer. Sometimes they'll just ignore them. And I think that is a detriment. They can go again to those partisan news outlets, whether on the right or the left, that are available, and they can evade tough accountability journalism. But I will say, you know, the bright line is that there are a lot of great local reporters. They're just understaffed. They're underfunded. A lot of times they don't have the time to put in the stories because editors want quicker turns, because the newsrooms, as you said, have been cut back. So they need something to fill that digital hole. So they're asked to do more with less. There's a lot of valiant reporters trying to do the good work out there. They're just trying, they're doing it with, you know, one hand instead of two.
In your article, and you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but I'd like to expand on it, you cite a New York Times analysis that found that about 90% of the next Congress could be occupied by members who face nearly zero threat of losing a general election. Inside Elections, another source of nonpartisan analysis of House races, finds only 15 races as true toss-ups in the 2022 cycle. That does not sound like democracy as we've known it. Your thoughts?
Right. And so the initial reaction to this is that this is about gerrymandering. And for your listeners, you know, every 10 years, we get a reapportionment of our population in each state. And then you have legislators or sometimes boards redrawing the congressional maps. This is a highly partisan event where whichever party is in power in a certain state tries to draw the map to their advantage. So you get some very funny looking maps. Even in Kentucky, where Representative Comer's district, if you look at a map and look at his district, it doesn't make sense. It starts in the center of the state, it goes directly south, and then juts all the way west, sort of a reverse L. And it doesn't look like anything any architect would design, but that's sort of the standard for congressional districts that are redrawn by partisan legislators. And what that means is, you're drawing to protect your own. Democrats do it in their states. Republicans do it in Kentucky and in red-leaning states. And that means you're going to have less competitive general elections. And potentially, the only threat you have is in a primary where you have to go to the hard right or hard left, because your main challenge is defending your flank. And that goes back to the point that we spoke about before, which is why, you know, our country is just getting more partisan, more polarized, and there's less incentive to reach across the aisle, to go to the middle, to take a stance outside of your party, because your most competitive election every 2 years is a primary challenge, not a general election. And this isn't a new phenomenon. So, I mean, go back to 2010 when the Republicans had a big year and won 63 seats. Even in that year where you had a huge change in Congress, the biggest of the last decade or 12 years, 85% of the House remained. So 85% of incumbents still won that year in a huge wave change year. So I think that's just an important statistic to keep in mind, that even in years that we talk about big sweeping change and vote the bums out, most of the bums are going to stay in office.
Well, from 30,000 feet up now, given what's going on in our world right now, do you find it ironic that American democracy, cited globally as a model, is undergoing these changes that we're talking about at a time when Ukrainians are losing their lives in defense of democracy?
Yeah, I mean, given what happened in 2020, and you have the former president saying unfounded, untrue things about an election being stolen in 2020 and still repeating them to this day, it doesn't surprise me where we are 2 years later. It's tough to look overseas and see there's a comparison to, you know, the oldest democracy in the world. But I would say, you know, on the other hand, we're the only multi-ethnic democracy really on the planet, where we want everyone to come here, where we encourage all races, religions, and we're going to try this experiment. It is still an experiment in the making. I think, you know, in recent years, because of Donald Trump, that sort of ruptured our politics, maybe in a way that it's never going to go back to being the same. But the real problem, I think, is truth. And when you deny a truth that the election was without fraud, that there wasn't enough fraud to overturn it, then that is going to incite irreparable harm to the country, and particularly people that believe it and want to believe everything that the former president has to say. That makes it very difficult to operate as politically and even journalistically.
All right, that's David Catanese, a national political correspondent for McClatchy, based in Washington, D.C. Thank you, David.
Thank you, sir.
Primary elections in Kentucky are set for May 17th, but early voting is available to any registered voter on the Thursday, Friday, or Saturday before Election Day. That's May 12th, 13th, or 14th. Check with your county clerk to get the location and times. Coming up after the break, who were John and Alan Lomax?
Perhaps the most renowned folklorists of the 20th century.
What is devised theater?
So it's just really our way of telling our story.
And what is Rural Assembly Everywhere?
A virtual festival of rural culture and examination of rural issues.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives. Members of local co-ops can receive renewable solar power through the Cooperative Solar Program. More information is at cooperativesolar.com.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Nathan Salzberg is a guitarist, composer, archivist, and writer living in Louisville. In his capacity with the Association for Cultural Equity, Nathan is curator of an important piece of American cultural history, the Digital Archive of Field Recordings of Eastern Kentucky Musicians taped by Alan Lomax nearly a century ago. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Nathan.
Thank you, Tom. I'm very glad to be here at last.
And yes, and let's begin with at square A. Who were John and Alan Lomax, and why are they important to American cultural history?
I think it's safe to say that John and Alan Lomax, who were father and son, perhaps the most renowned folklorists of the 20th century, and perhaps had the largest influence on our understanding and appreciation of American folk music, purely because they were not just antiquarians recording this stuff for the sake of sticking it on archive shelves, but because of their devotion to disseminating it through books and records and later TV and film. Between the two of them, they made many, many, many hundreds of hours of recordings all over the American South. And in Alan's case, all over Western Europe and the Eastern Caribbean, North Africa. And Alan, in particular, was devoted to the idea of cultural equity, that all these little site-specific cultural traditions not just had a right to, but deserved and should be encouraged to express themselves in media and in the classroom and on the public stage.
Well, there were several trips made to Eastern Kentucky. Did both father and son make those trips, or was it just Alan alone?
Yes, the first trip was made in 1933, and the Lomaxes started making their recordings in the summer of 1933. John Lomax had lost his job at a bank in Austin, Texas during the Depression, and he had had a lifelong interest in folk song, having grown up in rural Bosque County, Texas, alongside the old Chisholm Trail, listening to the cowboys sing. And he made a proposal to the Macmillan Publishing Company to go out and collect songs for the sake of what became several books of American folk songs. But the idea originally was not to record. The idea was just to document on, you know, textually. The Library of Congress got involved and offered a what was then state-of-the-art instantaneous recording disc that, with all of its fixins, weighed about 350 pounds and was stuffed into the back of their Packard. And they drove throughout the South the summer of 1933, primarily recording African-American folk song, and specifically the work songs of Black prisoners throughout the Southern penitentiary system, which were basically at that time just modernized, plantations with the prisoners acting as slaves for behalf of the states. Anyway, when they ended up in Kentucky in 1933, they visited a scholar named Harvey Fewson, who John Lomax had known from Fewson's 1931 book called Ballads of the Kentucky Highlands. Fewson was one of the first Kentuckians to do the research into the old-time ballad tradition of the mountains. But Fewson had invited the Lomaxes down, saying that though he had done this work, he had no means to get the music. He didn't have the recording machine. So the Lomaxes came in 33 and just recorded a few songs then with this phenomenal fiddler and singer who's known as Blind Jim Howard, who lived in Harlan. So that 1933 trip was the only time that John Lomax recorded in Kentucky. But Alan came back in 1937 for what became really sort of the centerpiece of his Kentucky collections, which was this 2.5 month, some 50 hours worth of recordings that he collected over the course of the fall of 1937.
And we're going to hear a couple of samples from those recordings in just a minute. But I just want to kind of circle back to what you said a moment ago and emphasize that this was the 1930s. They didn't have an iPhone that they could pop into their pocket. As you mentioned, it was a huge recorder. They didn't have nice, big, comfy SUVs. It was in the back of a Packard. This was difficult work.
It certainly was. There was no interstate at this time. You know, they were fording creeks. They were lugging the machine up hollers into places where the car could not reach. They were trying as best they could in those cases to run as much electrical wire as they possibly could to utilize the car battery. In some cases, the recordings could end up being all over the place speed-wise because of depending on the state of the electricity, you know, the direct current in a particular hotel room or cabin or wherever they ended up recording. I mean, it really is a wonder they were able to do this. And they did it day in and day out. And in some cases, they would stop in a settlement, set up for several days and record as many people as they could. You know, maybe they had a lead on a particular singer in a particular county or a particular town. They would go and meet with that person and they would say, oh, you need to, you know, record my cousin who plays fiddle. And then so-and-so would come by and maybe someone's fiddle student would come over and, you know, and you would end up being able to document this whole community and make it sort of hang out for a couple of days. But in other cases, they were just several little communities, three or four in a single day, to say nothing of the church services they recorded, children's game songs in schools. I mean, it really boggles the mind that the Lomaxes were able to do any one of these trips and that they just kept doing them over and over and over for many, many years.
Well, let's take a moment to get into some of this music and listen to a sampling from the collection I have queued up here, Bonaparte's Retreat, a song that has been covered by many over the years, but we have the original here, I believe. Nathan, tell us who we're about to hear and when and where this was recorded.
This is one of the first recordings of this tune. It's not the first, but it did become the most iconic version, not simply because the fiddler is phenomenal. His name was Bill Stepp. William Hamilton Stepp was his given name. He was the illegitimate son of a white man of some well standing in, I think, around Sawyersville, and a half Indian prostitute. And Bill Stepp lived his first 5 years under a little cliff overhang somewhere near Beattyville by a creek. But he was a phenomenal fiddler. He was a terrible husband. Apparently he was married 7 times. He walked out on one wife when she was on her deathbed so he could go play a dance. But he was given a lot of leeway because he was the best fiddler going, certainly one of them. And his version of Bonaparte's Retreat was recorded by Alan, and I should not leave her out, his wife, Elizabeth Lomax, who accompanied him on this trip. Again, in 1937 in Sawyersville. The tune was later repurposed by Aaron Copland for the use in the hoedown scene in Agnes DeMille's rodeo ballet. From there, it ended up being utilized yet again by, if you remember, the prog rock band ELP, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and then for a Beef It's What's for Dinner commercial. So in a way, it had one of the furthest reaches of any of Lomax's recordings, but this is the original we're about to hear.
Well, that's so interesting. So we're going to listen to Bill William Hamilton, W.H. Stepp, performing his song Bonaparte's Retreat. So we just heard a passage from the Alan Lomax recording of William Hamilton, or W.H. Stepp, performing his song Bonaparte's Retreat. Another, captured in that same year, 1937, in Harlan County, was of the Pine Mountain Girls Octet, and they were singing Pretty Polly. What can you tell us about that?
This is a really, really interesting and not entirely representative piece of music. Obviously, the Lomaxes were interested at this time, and were throughout their careers, in what they would, however problematically, refer to as authentic folk music. So whatever the definition of authentic folk music actually is has been argued vociferously over the years, and for good reason. And, you know, they were visiting at a time in 1937 when Kentucky old time, what we now call old time music, had been documented on phonograph records since 1924 or 25 or so. And of course, the phonograph and the radio was reaching into East Kentucky sometime before the Lomaxes visited. So the idea that they were going to come and get this sort of undiluted, perfect distillate of East Kentucky music, totally unaffected by outside media, was fanciful and not the case. But this is one of the most interesting pieces they recorded because it's almost art song. And it was performed by a group called the Pine Mountain Girls Octet. They were organized by the Pine Mountain School's director, Glenn Morris, who's a fascinating character in his own right. He was born in South Wales in the coal fields, moved to northeastern Pennsylvania, the anthracite coal fields, and then came to East Kentucky, where he ran the Pine Mountain Settlement School. And he had organized this octet of young women who were singing traditional material, ballads and hymns, in this very haunting four-part harmony, two voices on each part. And they had just come back when the Lomaxes recorded them from an extensive tour, raising money for the school and sort of promoting the school's, mission of cultural preservation and vocational education in East Kentucky. They'd performed for the Roosevelt White House. They performed for Henry Ford in Detroit. And Lomax was luckily there on hand to capture their recordings because these are the only recordings made of theirs. And there's just a couple and they're fragmentary. And this is Glenn Morris's arrangements for the octet of the traditional murder ballad, Pretty Polly, which was all over Eastern Kentucky and Central Appalachia for many years, recorded by many, many people. But this is a haunting, perhaps the most haunting version of a haunting song, the Pine Mountain Girls Octet.
We just heard the Pine Mountain Girls Octet performing Pretty Polly, one of the Alan Lomax recordings. And as I mentioned in the introduction, Nathan, you're a musician, composer, recording artist. I wonder, have you been influenced by music found in the Lomax collection?
Absolutely. I mean, if I tried not to be, it would be an impossible effort. I mean, there are so many phenomenal performers and performances. And of course, we're talking about folk music. So we're not talking about necessarily virtuosity in the sense that we are used to from, you know, professional musicians, whatever that even means now. There are, you know, as a guitarist, there are guitarists in the collection that have absolutely changed the way that I approach the instrument. One in particular is named E.C. Ball, who is from Southwest Virginia. Estel Cortez Ball, phenomenal flat picker and fingerstyle guitarist. Beautiful, beautiful songwriter and singer. And the list just goes on and on and on and on. And, you know, it's a great blessing that I have to have access to this music now for nearly 22 years. And I'm always finding new discoveries, always having my mind blown by things that I didn't know existed.
And can we find and listen to these recordings online?
You certainly can. All of the Lomax Kentucky recordings. So this spans 1933 to 1942 on those original acetate discs. And then there are later recordings from Kentucky that Alan Lomax made in 1959 on stereo tape, predominantly of the old time lined out hymns of the old Regular Baptist Church of East Kentucky in Letcher County. And then footage is on our YouTube channel. All of the recordings one can find through archive.culturalequity.org, which is the Lomax Digital Archive, which is the clearinghouse now for all of the digitized Lomax recordings that we have been working on. And if I may say, those earlier Kentucky recordings, which are the lion's share of the Kentucky collections, around 70 hours of recordings all told, 1933 to 1942, were digitized and cataloged in a four-part collaboration between the Association for Cultural Equity and the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress, as well as Berea College's Special Collections and University of Kentucky Special Collections.
All right, that's Nathan Salzberg with us from Louisville. Nathan is curator of the Alan Lomax Archive for the Association of Cultural Equity. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
What is devised theater, and how does it differ from improv? We're about to find out from Bill McCann's guest in this latest in his series on theater production and performance in Kentucky.
My guest today is Dr. Kimberly Miller, Associate Professor of Communication Arts and Theater Arts at University of the Cumberland in Williamsburg, Kentucky, where she's taught since 2008. Dr. Miller teaches a variety of theater arts courses, including acting and the plays of Shakespeare and others in the traditional theater canon. Yet in the last few years, she's also begun to focus her attention on teaching and directing improvisation and creating works of devised theater. So, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Dr. Miller, what is devised theater?
So, devised theater is when a group of people come together to tell a story about something that interests them. They can be people who maybe have a theater background, maybe they don't, and what they produce might have a traditional script, but it may not. It may have a soundscape or be a series of images or movements. It really is much more relaxed than a traditional script.
Okay. And how does that differ from improvisation? It sounds like the same thing.
Well, we use improvisation to start developing the story and seeing what interests us. So when I do improvisation, you know, we create it in the moment and then it's gone. And in devised theater, we use the improvisation, but eventually we do solidify a story or a script or whatever it is we're trying to perform. So by the time it's in front of an audience, it has been rehearsed just like a traditional play.
Why create theatrical works from scratch? Aren't there plenty of scripts available?
There are plenty of scripts available, but one of the things that I've noticed, my students at the University of the Cumberland, they're dealing with all the same issues and conflicts and problems that anyone else is. But in Eastern Kentucky, we're not going to talk about it in the same way. We're not going to address it the way that a New York City playwright might address these same topics. So we've started devising theater so that we can talk about things that are important to us and our point of view in the world, and not get tied down into, well, can we change this character? Do we have to say this word? So it's just really our way of telling our story.
You're telling your story. So what kinds of ideas have you been implementing as devised theater works? Where are your topics?
We're working right now on our fifth show, and some of the shows that have come before. I had two senior students a couple years ago, is before the pandemic. And they got together and they interviewed people, and they came up with this show called What I Wish I Had Known. And this is about what it's like to be dating the guy from church in the perfect relationship, you know, on the face of it, but the way that he behaves when other people are not around, what is expected behind closed doors. They actually interviewed a woman who had married a man that she met through church. And everyone was expecting them to start a family, but he didn't want to consummate the relationship. So what do you do when you're in that situation where on the surface of it, you are doing the good thing, the right thing, but behind closed doors, your relationship looks very different.
Oh, wow.
So that's one of the things they addressed. I had another student who was interested in psychology and had been inspired by Impressionism. And so she came up with a installation piece called States of Mind, the Energy of Emotion. And she cast people to play specific emotions and gave them rules to interact with the audience as they walked through the theater. So it's really whatever's on our mind.
So what is an installation piece? I haven't heard that term before, I don't think.
So an installation piece is, rather than being a standard script with the audience comes in, the play starts at a certain time and runs from beginning to end, and then the audience leaves. The installation piece was, she rearranged the theater. Each of the actors had a part of the theater that represented the energy or the mood that they were depicting. And then we opened up the theater between 2 or 3 hours, and the audience could come or go as they wanted to. So she did have sort of a stage manager who greeted everyone when they came into the theater and told them what the ground rules were. But some people would sort of walk through if this wasn't to their cup of tea. They may have only stayed 5-10 minutes, just kind of walk through all the areas where there were actors. And she had done some muslin paintings. She'd painted on muslin to suggest what the emotions are. And, you know, and some people came in and really interacted with the space and interacted with the cast, and they stayed for 45 minutes.
Okay, so interact how?
And well, as I said, like, I don't have all the rules off the top of my head, but each actor represented an emotion or a state of mind.
Okay.
And then based on the study that she had done about that state of mind, they could interact with the audience and each other following specific rules. So, for example, aggression would interact with everybody and would have free reign of all the space of the theater. But bashfulness only had like a corner, and the person had to stay in that corner. And so people would have to go over to speak to that actor. And the student based this on people with different mental attitudes, different mental diseases, perceive color and emotion differently. So she was trying to depict that.
So how does the rehearsal process of a devised work differ from that of a traditional play or a musical?
Well, what we've been doing is I've been teaching devised theater through a class. So we set aside a period of time where I introduce the devising work of other successful groups, and we talk about their methodologies and what sounds interesting to the people I'm currently working with. And then we just start devising. A lot of it is improvisation, and we pick out what story elements or characters sound really interesting to us or really engaging. And then we just start building off of that. And it depends on the interest of the people in the class.
Okay.
How that's going to roll. Right now, I've got students who are really interested in music and are music makers. So sometimes instead of bringing in a monologue or a dialogue, they'll bring in a song or a tune that they think is important that they created. And then we just start putting it together and solidifying it. So I've told the device theater class that by the time the term is over, here in about 2.5 weeks, they have to have a finished product. You know, if it's only 10 minutes long, that's fine. But I think with this group, we're looking at a full-fledged production.
Wow.
Now, we will take this into production in the fall with potentially a different group of students, and they will also have an opportunity to revise or comment on or shape the story as, you know, fits for them.
Do you have a traditional set involved?
We usually do. Due to COVID, the show that we did last fall, which was called Redemption, just the way it worked out, I actually had students build a part of a set before the device theater class started. So that when the device theater class started, I just said to them, okay, here's your set. You need to make this make sense. And they did it. So we really adjust what we are doing to the interests and the skill sets of the students who are involved.
And what kind of set did you have that they had to create from?
The students who were working on the set, I told them that they needed to have a set that had two or three different levels, a textile element, and then a surprise. And they tossed the idea around for a day, and then they planned for a day, and what they came up with was a shipwreck.
Oh.
And so we started tapping into the mythology or the folklore around ghost pirate ships. And we discovered through the process that there's actually several strong ties between pirates and Kentucky, and between ghost pirate ships, some of that lore actually has its roots in Kentucky. So that was a fun find to come across.
You've been doing devised theater now for several years. Do you keep your scripts and revive them and do them again? Or are they one and done?
We do keep the scripts. And I make a deal with the students that have been the main contributors that if they want to take the scripts and revise them and take them out into the communities where they land once they graduate, that's fine. We've not yet felt a need to bring anything back because we're always generating new material. But what I like about devising is if the students do say, you know, now that I've been out of school 2 or 3 years, I'd like to revisit this and reshape this, that's fine with me. We all own it.
Now, many colleges encourage students to write and direct shows, usually 10-minute plays, one-act plays. Have your students done any of those as devised works?
The devised works have varied in length. Most of the students have to take the principles of directing class where they're required to direct at least a 10-minute play. And then if they want to move forward and do other things, that's up to the student to, you know, to get my approval, make sure that's something we can do. But specifically targeting like a 10-minute play as a devised work, we've not yet done that. We've just started with our topic or what interests us and let it develop into what it's going to become.
So are you and your students currently working on a devised work? And if so, when will it be produced?
Yes, the devised theater class is every spring, and we are working currently on a musical. We've tentatively called it It Only Gets Better From Here because that is a line from the song we think is going to open the show. And that will go up in the first part of October next fall.
Well, Dr. Kimberly Miller is Director of Theater at University of the Cumberlands. Thank you for being here, Dr. Miller, to discuss devised theater.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on May 10th and 11th, Rural Assembly Everywhere, an event put on by the Center for Rural Strategies based in Whitesburg. Whitney Kimball Coe is Vice President for National Programs for the Center, and she's here with us with details. Hi, Whitney.
Hi there.
What is the Rural Assembly Everywhere?
Rural Assembly Everywhere is a virtual event that it's been turned from an in-person event that the Rural Assembly would host biannually into this virtual event. And we're calling it a virtual festival of rural culture and examination of rural issues. And hopefully it brings hundreds of people together from across the country and all the states to this virtual space.
Okay, how about a little bit of background? What was the motivation driving the development of the event?
Actually, it was COVID, you know, when everything shut down in 2020, and much of the rural assembly's work has been in person and in shared spaces with other rural leaders across the country. And we realized we needed to keep those connections and we needed to keep feeding those relationships. So we developed a virtual gathering that we've done twice a year since October 2020. So now this is our fourth or fifth one. And in the past, we've done some that are focused on, you know, rural women specifically, or some that are focused on rural policy and democracy. This one that's coming up in May will be focused more on rural culture and identity. So we've got a number of really wonderful speakers and conversations that are going to be happening with a really diverse group of folks.
And who would you say is your target audience?
I mean, I would say it's everywhere, so it's for everyone. But, you know, it's really for rural advocates or people who feel some sort of affinity to rural America, whether they were born there and maybe they left or maybe they are still there. We also welcome the rural curious, you know, folks who maybe are from a city and are wondering what's going on with rural America and in rural communities. So really, it's those rural leaders and the rural curious that we're very interested in coming to this event. But we also get, you know, media outlets and funders and policymakers, in fact.
Would you say if you're living in a big city and you're thinking of bailing out from that life and you're thinking about rural life, would this be something good to tap into to get some sense of what you might find?
Well, absolutely. Of course, you know, if you've been... What's the saying? If you've been to one rural community, you've been to that rural community. So I do think that, you know, folks who are intrigued by rural America writ large would get a lot out of this these conversations because there will be so much diversity.
Okay. And is there a fee and do people need to register?
We do ask that people register just so we can keep you updated about speakers and programming and how to log on and those kinds of things. But it is free. So if you go to ruralassembly.org, I think that's the first thing you see on that page is the event itself and a link to register. And once we have your information, we're able to communicate to you about new speakers as we get them and also let you know about some of the breakout sessions that will be happening after the main event. So you'll have Zoom links to join. So this really opens the door for people from all over the country to participate. In fact, the last event we had, I think we had 900 registrants from 9 different countries and all 50 states.
Whitney Kimball Coe is Vice President for National Programs at the Center for Rural Strategies in Whitesburg, getting ready for this year's virtual event, Rural Assembly Everywhere, happening online May 10th and 11th. Thank you, Whitney.
Thank you.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org and on the WEKU app, NPR One, and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.